So just to introduce myself, my name is Rich Arstead. I am the state archivist at the Montana Historical Society. I've been there for 25 years. I was raised in Libby, Montana. My dad was a member of the Lumber and Sawmill Workers Union. My maternal grandfather was a member of the United Mine Workers of America. So I've got union on both sides of my family. I went to the University of Montana where I did my graduate work. And there I wrote a thesis on the 1917 timber strike that started in northwest Montana during World War I, about 2 weeks after the United States got into World War I. And that kind of got me hooked on doing labor stuff. And then I went to work at the Historical Society, and then I got involved with the union local that was at the Historical Society, and became the president of that and did a few other things. And it's kind of like the mafia. Once you're in, you can never get out. They just keep pulling you back until one day you either wake up with a horse head in bed with you or somebody's tying a brick to your ankle and dropping you into a deep pool. So anyhow, I'm here. So I've been doing labor presentations now for about 10 years, mostly for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. I've done a few for the Montana Professional Firefighters and some for the Boilermakers. Usually the presentation to cover Montana's rich history in organized labor takes anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. So strap in. It's going to be a long night for a Monday, but you'll be okay because I brought my timekeeper with me. My wife is sitting in the back corner. She's got the clock going on her phone. We're going to try to do this in 40 minutes. And I did math, which is always interesting to do because I have a liberal arts degree and we just don't do math. And it breaks out to be about 90 seconds per slide, and I have 33 slides. So, like I said, it's going to be a bumpy ride, but we'll get through it together, okay?
All right.
Okay. So, we all know that Butte gets the big headline for being the Gibraltar of labor in the Rocky Mountain West, right?
Yeah.
Well, guess what? They're 12 years late. The first union established in Montana Territory was in 1866. It was in Helena, Montana, and they represented the typesetters for the newspapers in the territory. Local 95. And the first strike in Montana was not in Butte, America. It was in Virginia City and Nevada City in 1867. So you can tell all your Butte friends that Butte has been eclipsed by the typographical union. And the interesting thing is that we have the records for the Helena Typographical Union, and they actually represented the entire territory for a number of years. They're local number 95, so as far as national locals affiliated with a national union, that's a pretty low number, which means they're around pretty early. They actually were in operation until the 1990s when they merged with the communication workers. So that's the longest running union that we have in the state. But we do have to give a nod to Butte, because it is known as the Gibraltar, as most of you probably already. Anybody from Butte? No. So I don't have to worry about anybody pulling me aside afterwards and saying, hey, I'm from Butte. Where'd Curtis go? Pull the door shut. She's outside? Yeah. All right, we can talk all kinds of trash. I also use expletives, so just be aware. I know. They slip out. So it's what it is. So first thing that really set the stage for organized labor in Montana, of course, was Butte. And that's because it was a heavy industrial area. And if you look at Montana, we still have a fair number of unions across the state. I think the state AFL-CIO says that they have 50,000, 55,000 union members across the state. What some people don't realize is we lost most of the industrial unionism between 1972 and about 2010 with the closure of the Anaconda Company, the closure of its smelters, the closure of the lumber mills in Bonner and Eureka and in Libby and places like that where they were organized as labor as well. But a lot of that sprang out of what happened in Butte. So in 1878, a couple of the miners mine owners in the Butte area decided that they were going to cut wages of the unskilled miners. Not the skilled miners, the unskilled miners. And so the unskilled miners went out on work. Well, an interesting thing happened. The skilled miners decided they didn't like that idea, so they went on strike as well. And it wasn't really a by-the-book win. It was a 50-50 split. One of the mine owners... Well, I know, right? He said 96 seconds per slide. This is way over. So one of the mine owners decided to go ahead and reinstate the wage, and so the workers went back to work. The other one held out, and they went back to work without the increase in pay. But it started the Butte Mine Workers Union, Workingmen's Union. And they, at first, organized everybody. They didn't care what you did, as long as you worked and you received a wage, you can join the union. So they had everybody from firefighters to miners to carpenters to the local gravedigger, whatever. And by the time the 1890s came along, Butte was heavily organized. Montana itself was pretty interested in taking care of workers back then as well. So 1889, statehood is granted. 1891, you have the first state legislature meeting. During the Constitutional Convention in 1889, there was a couple of members from the Butte Miners Union, the Butte Workingmen's Union, who were delegates at that Constitutional Convention, who pushed for a constitutional amendment saying that there would be an 8-hour day for everybody. Well, it failed during the Constitutional Convention in 1889, so when the 1891 session came up, there was a legislator from Butte who was, again, part of the Butte Mine Workers Union, the Butte Workingmen's Union, and he put forward a bill for an 8-hour day, this time just for hard rock miners. That's it. The legislature debated it pretty aggressively. It looked like it might gain some traction and actually get passed, but there were two or three vocal individuals on the outside of the legislature who spoke out against it. One of them happened to be a former member of the Butte Union and who was running a magazine in Butte at the time. And I'm not going to get into names or anything like that. If you want the rest of the story, it's kind of like Paul Harvey. You got to invite me back, like, several times. So, anyhow, the Butte Miners Union actually put a hit list together that they hung in their union hall. These are the individuals that we're targeting because they shot down the 8-hour day law. And the gentleman that ran the magazine in Butte stepped out of his office one evening and somebody shot him. They never did convict anybody for it. They arrested a couple of people. The county attorney did his best to gather evidence to put the individuals in jail. Couldn't get enough evidence and they ended up releasing him. But it also meant that there was no 8-hour day for Montana workers during that legislative session. And it would be a while before that happened. And so the next significant labor event occurred also during that legislative session in 1891 when this gentleman, E.D. Matz, put forward a bill for the establishment of a Labor Day in Montana. Now, most of you know about the Haymarket Square event and the International Workers choosing May 1 as the International Workers' Day and all of that kind of good stuff. Well, corporate unionism in the United States really wanted to stay away from May Day because it was just too radical, as far as they were concerned, to touch. So they decided that if there was going to be a Labor Day in America, it should be the first Monday in September. And so by 1891, a few states had already established a Labor Day. Montana was one of the first 10 to do so, and one of the first 10 to do so before it became a federal holiday that nobody really gets off. But it's still a holiday, right? Right. Just to give you an idea about labor activity in Montana between 1886 and 1894, here's a hit list of some of the strikes that occurred across the state. And you'll see that it covers just about everybody from hard rock miners to newspapermen to coal miners to granite cutters, pretty much you name it, they were going out on a strike. Most of the strikes were economically driven. Sometimes there was a safety issue to consider, but most of the time everybody was looking for a bit more money. And one of the things that benefited early labor in Montana was the fighting between the Copper Kings in Butte. Marcus Daly, William Andrews Clark, Augustus F. Heinze, didn't get along. And so what they did was they used their workforce to basically piss one another off. So the eight-hour day in Montana, when it was finally passed in 1901, wasn't passed because all of a sudden Montana industry decided that there needed to be an eight-hour day for hard rock miners. It passed because William Andrews Clark and Augustus F. Heinze got together and decided that they wanted to twist Marcus Daly's tail. And so they pushed for an eight-hour day. And with two of the three Copper Kings pushing for an eight-hour day, Marcus Daly really didn't have a lot of choice but to jump on the bandwagon as well, reluctantly. So the Copper Kings fighting actually aided the organization of labor. And you got to think about the size and mass of the Anaconda Company at this time, too. We're talking Butte, where they're working underground. We're talking Anaconda when they're doing smelting. We're talking East Helena, which is not part of the Anaconda Company holdings yet, but they're still doing smelting operations, so they're organized as well. You're talking Great Falls. Plus, you're talking about all the timber industry that goes around in support of mining. So Bonner, Milltown over by Missoula. Milltown was operated by William Andrews Clark. Bonner was operated by the Anaconda Company holdings. Mill up in Summers, Montana was the Great Northern Railway Company. So, again, all of that kind of spawned off of the Anaconda Company, and that's what kind of caused that ripple effect where labor organized out around that. Now, that doesn't mean that the trades weren't around. The trades have been around for a long, long time. So having the Carpenters Union and the Masons and the Teamsters and things like that were well established before Butte became a growing concern. So they found an easy purchase when they started settling in Montana and organizing locals in Montana for the trades. So 1893, 1894, 1895 was a hot time in Montana. There were at least three major labor events that occurred. The first was the March of Coxey's Army. I'm not going to get into that too much, just a bunch of poor, out-of-work workers, most of them single, trying to figure out a way how they could make a living. I will tell you that one of the fun things about labor history in Montana is finding out the number of times they borrowed a train from the railroad to get from point A to B. Nobody was ever charged with stealing the train. They just borrowed it. Eventually, they'd give it back, but they borrowed them. And they did that quite a bit. So you had Coxey's Army in 1894. You had Governor Rickards, who was the governor, the second governor of the state of Montana at that time, decide we got to do something about all these out-of-work workers in this state. And they were starting to call these groups as they congregated together industrial armies. So what Rickards did was he created the Department of Agriculture, Labor, and Industry. So Montana had a labor department. Well, Montana had theirs in 1894. The United States didn't create a labor department for the country until 1917. So that shows you how progressive Montana was in terms of trying to handle its labor force at the time. So he created the labor industry to kind of keep an eye on and figure out what was going on with the labor strikes that were going on and everything. Right after the Coxey's Army thing settled down, and they actually sent federal troops to stop them from getting the train out of the state, there was a strike in Chicago at the Pullman factory. The workers that made the fancy sleeper cars and things like that for the railroad, they went on strike when Pullman Jr. decided to cut wages and cut hours for the workers. Now, the Pullman facility was set up as a model community. So the workers lived in company housing. They bought from the company store, and they used company script. So the company owned everything. So when Pullman Jr. cut the wages of the workers, he didn't lower the rents. He didn't lower the cost of food and things like that. And so the Pullman workers went on strike. They realized that they didn't have enough power to carry that out on their own, that they were going to need some assistance. So they turned to Eugene Debs and the American Railway Union. The American Railway Union was a fairly new thing, only been about a year old. Eugene Debs made his way up through the railroad brotherhoods, and realized that the Brotherhood spent so much time fighting with one another that they really weren't representing railroad workers. And so this is why he came up with the American Railway Union. And the American Railway Union had a lot of success organizing across the country. So the Pullman workers went to Debs and asked him to take the American Railway Union out on strike as well. Debs said, no, we can't do that. We're not old enough, we're not mature enough to pull something like that off. What we can do is boycott any train that has a Pullman car on it, because not every train had a Pullman car on it, right? There's a lot of freight and things like that. So the last thing you want to do is start messing with interstate commerce, because then it becomes a federal thing. So, okay, you can't go out on strike. A boycott sounds good. So that's what they did. They called a boycott on any train that was pulling a Pullman car. None of the ARU members would touch that train, work that train. And so Livingston was a huge switching point for the Northern Pacific Railway. And so it was one of the first places that was hit by that. The railroad barons weren't without their own resources. When they found out what the plan of the ARU was, they simply attacked the issue by attaching a Pullman car on every single train. And so not only are they messing with interstate commerce, but they're also messing with the U.S. mail, because mail's not being delivered. And this is how money, this is before Bitcoin. So there's no fake money out there. Everything's hard cash, and it's being transported by train and all that kind of good stuff, the reserve notes and all that kind of good things. So by shutting down completely the train industry, you really put a bite on the federal government. So for the very, well, I shouldn't say the very first time, for the second time in the history of the United States Army, they were called out to break a strike. And troops were placed in Billings, which is the photograph that you saw, and troops were placed in Livingston to make sure that the trains ran. And eventually they ended up breaking this strike. Eugene Debs ended up going to prison for a couple of years, the first of many times he would go to prison. And they pretty much put the bite on the railroad unions for a while. Here are some of the headlines from the Livingston Enterprise and the Billings newspaper about the strikes. Interesting thing about the photograph back there. The photograph, if you look at it, are a bunch of U.S. soldiers, but there's one woman standing in amongst the group, and that's Calamity Jane. So that's 1894 for the railroad. 1893... they saw a big series of strikes in the silver mines in the Idaho Panhandle. And if you take I-90 West and go through that panhandle now, you see all those little silver mining communities and so forth. That's where the strike activity occurred. So a lot like the Butte Miners Union, those locals weren't affiliated with one another. They were local, independent unions, little unions. And the silver owners realized in Idaho that they could isolate those little unions, pockets of unionism, individually, and snuff them out. And that's what they did one by one by one. They put a bullpen in the center of town. Wallace had a pretty big one, basically just a big open enclosure that was guarded, barbed wire, all that kind of good stuff. And anybody that was on strike got thrown in the bullpen so that the scabs could go in and work. So they did that and broke a lot of the little unions in there. The Butte Miners Union was lucky because, well, it was in Butte. It was one of the highest paid locales in the Hard Rock Mining District, so there wasn't a lot of cause for them to go out to work. They were organized and they had a fairly strong union, but they realized that if they were going to last for very long, they had to get together and form a single entity to represent all the Hard Rock miners. And so they got together in Butte in 1894 and formed the Western Federation of Miners. And the Western Federation of Miners operated from 1894 till 1916 when they changed their name to Protect the Innocent and became the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers. And then they merged with the Steel Workers Union in 1968. So they were around for quite a while. So Butte was the focal point of hard rock mining in the West. The first couple of presidents of the Western Federation of Miners actually came from the Butte Miners Union. And fun story, those guys were so radical that the organization almost tore itself apart. So in their third annual conference, they got together and passed a resolution saying that they couldn't elect anybody from the Butte Miners Union again. And they didn't until the 1940s. So They pretty much shut Butte out. So, just kind of an idea of what's going on, what we call the Gilded Age. Back then, the 1890s into the early 20th century, I think you'd probably say that we're in a Gilded Age right now, where the money is way up here, and there's a whole lot of people down here. And so, as you can see from the number of organizations that are forming and the strikes that are occurring during this time period, there's a lot of unrest that's going on. And there's the use of private armies to break union strikes and things like that. During the 1890s, the Pinkerton Detective Agency had a larger strike-breaking force than there were men in the United States Army. And they were for hire. Their one goal was to go around and break strikes across the country. Butte, about this time, became known as the greatest labor camp on earth. So I plucked this from the Butte Bystander in 1897, and I only listed the top 20 unions listed in the newspaper. There were over 30 unions, organized, operating, functional unions in Butte in 1897. That's just in Butte. That doesn't cover what was in Great Falls. It doesn't cover what was in Livingston. There was a little bit in Bozeman, places like that. But where there was any type of heavy industry and so forth, they were heavily unionized in Montana. So things sailed along pretty decently. Marcus Daly died, but before he died, he sold out to the Rockefellers. Standard Oil moved in. It was a different breed of cat. The situation was looking pretty grim. And in 1905, the Western Federation of Miners, the Montana Federation of Labor, what we know as the Montana AFL-CIO now, and several other groups, including anarchists and socialists and communists, got together in Chicago and formed the Industrial Workers of the World. And the Industrial Workers of the World was a line in the sand. It was basically the working class saying, you know what, we're tired of the disparity in wages and disparity of making a living, making a decent living and things like this. So we're no longer about a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. We're all about a class revolution. This scared the hell out of everybody. And it's this association with the IWW that would really put a pinch on organized labor across the country and in Montana for a number of years. And it began relatively soon in Montana. First IWW strike in Montana was 1907. It was not Butte, just so you know. It was timber workers that worked for the Anaconda Company, but it wasn't Butte, right? Right. So beginning in 1914, labor started blowing this up, literally. In 1914, the members of the Butte Miners Union felt that their leadership had sold out the workers. So they dynamited their own union hall to the ground. Took several charges of dynamite, but you have to admire the fact that there's a building standing right next to it, and they didn't drop that one. They just dropped their own. Now, they were smart enough to get their safe out of there in their book listing the membership and so forth. And then they had a separate election and tried to form a different union that was independent of the Western Federation of Miners. Now, the Western Federation of Miners took this pretty seriously because the Butte Miners Union was local number one of the Western Federation of Miners. If they lost that, there wasn't much left to hold the WFM together. And so they tried to put the pieces back together. This is the first time that a governor of the state of Montana called out the National Guard to put down the strike in Butte. Mucky McDonald and his cohort were the ones in charge of the strike activity in the Butte area. You'll see the soldiers there with the machine gun that's actually set up outside of the courthouse in Butte up on the hill. And on the other side of that is the Carpenters Union Hall. So it was a war between labor and corporate America at that time. It's also the beginning of World War I in Europe, and so nobody's really too sure what's going on. What the workers know is that Europe is going to need a lot of the material that they're pulling out of the ground in Butte. And so the company is going to be making money hands over fist. They're not going to get a wage increase. The other thing that they're up against is they're up against the Rockefellers and Standard Oil. This is a new breed of cat for them. They've never gone up against anybody like this. The strongman for the Anaconda Company in Butte was John D. Ryan. He had a lieutenant, and I'm immediately going to forget his name. That's the allergy medicine, too. Okay, so a no-name individual who was the strong man for him. I'll think of it later. So they put Mucky McDonald and a couple of individuals on trial for kidnapping. Convicted Mucky and one of the others, sent him to Montana State Prison for a couple of years. This is 1914. The governor of the state of Montana at this time, Sam Stewart, is so worried about the IWW and a potential uprising that he asked President Wilson to station federal troops in Missoula in case there's an insurrection in the state. So before the United States even gets into World War I, they're preparing for war on the home front. And in 1917, the lid would blow off again, but not in Butte. Little Eureka, Montana, up in the northwest corner of the state. When the workers for the Eureka Lumber Company, the river drivers primarily, about 75 of them, walked out on strike 2 weeks after the United States declared war on Germany. The gentleman who was running the lumber company up there in Eureka, named Charles Wheel, was a member of the Montana legislature, was on friendly terms with the governor of the state of Montana. He claimed that the strikers were threatening the transcontinental line that ran through Eureka, the Great Northern Line, through. So the first place troops were put in anywhere during World War I, at the beginning of World War I in the United States, was Eureka, Montana. And they sent federalized National Guardsmen there, supposedly to protect the Transcontinental Railroad, but in actuality, they were there to break the strike. And from there, troops went from Eureka to Libby to Troy into the panhandle of Idaho and continued to work their way westward. By the time July 1 of 1917 hit, they estimate about 50,000 loggers were out on strike. They shut the timber industry down hard enough during World War I, the first part of World War I, that the federal government was diverting federal troops from France to Washington and Oregon to cut timber. So this is a big deal. And it, like I said, it happened before Butte. But Butte, always the show-off, decided to host a little event called the Granite Mountain Speculator Mine Fire, which resulted in the deaths of 168 miners. It was pretty horrific. The labor situation in Butte was tense. It wasn't unmanageable up until that point. When that happened, the miners got together and decided that they needed to reorganize again. They realized that the IWW was something that they did not want to touch. They did not want to become part of the Western Federation of Miners again either. So what they did was they tried to form an independent local once again. And so they went out on strike, and federal troops were stationed in Butte. As a matter of fact, one of World War II's more famous U.S. generals, Omar Bradley, spent World War I in Butte, America, making sure that the Butte miners behaved themselves. So things were pretty tense there. The other thing that was causing issue in Butte was the fact that Butte was full of immigrant workers. Ireland, Scotland, England, Germany, Finland, Russia, you name it, Butte had it. World War I is now World War II. There is no readily identifiable bad guy. So the Finnish don't want the United States going to war on the side of Russia. The Germans don't want the United States going on to war on the side of Great Britain. The Irish sure as hell doesn't want the United States to go to war on the side of Great Britain. So there was a few draft riots that they had in Butte that caused some issues as well. But probably the biggest thing that ignited in Butte was the assassination of Frank Little. Frank Little was kind of a troubleshooter for the IWW. He'd been around since the inception of the organization. He always ended up into the hottest spots of where the action was happening. As a matter of fact, when he rolled into Butte in late July of 1917, he was coming up from Bisbee, Arizona, where the mine owners in Bisbee actually put the striking workers and their families on a train, hauled them out in the middle of the desert, and kicked them out in the middle of the desert. They called it the Bisbee deportation. Okay, they deported him, but they deported him in the middle of nowhere with no food and water. So it's kind of an interesting scenario for sure. So Frank Little goes from Bisbee to to Butte. He's in Butte just a few days, makes a few firebrand speeches. None of them are really published in any of the local newspapers. All we know is that supposedly at one point he referred to U.S. Army soldiers as scabs in uniform. On August 1, three gentlemen break into his boarding house room in Butte, drag him out in the middle of the street, beat him up, tie him to the bumper of a Cadillac limousine, drag him a couple of blocks, decide that they're going to beat him up again. They untie him, throw him into the back of the Cadillac, drive to the edge of Butte, and lynch him. Largest funeral procession in Butte's history when they buried Frank Little. He's in the poverty section of the Mountain View Cemetery in Butte. You can go see it now. It's the grave's fixed up a lot better than what it used to be. The thing to me that's most fitting is Frank Little was there in support of the miners and the mine workers who were dying working underground. And so as you're standing at the foot of Frank Little's grave and you look up, you see the backside of the memorial that is to those unidentified bodies that they pulled out of the Speculator Granite Mountain fire. So I think Frank would be happy where his final resting place is. It's kind of interesting what people leave on his grave as tokens. So, and there's a great podcast called Death in the West. If you haven't listened to it, you should. It's a lot of fun. So most of this is about industrial unionism. Holy smoke, really? Okay. About industrial unionism. So, but that wasn't the only thing that was brewing across the country. In 1916, the American Federation of Teachers organized, and they had three locals briefly in Montana between 1920 and 1922. One of them was actually here in Bozeman at Montana State University, back when it was known as Montana College. One was at the University of Montana, and the other one was a grade school in Missoula that called themselves a club. So there was an attempt to organize public sector workers, something that hadn't occurred in the past. It was mostly private sector, so this is a first. In 1920, you also have the Anaconda Road Massacre, where Thomas Manning is shot and killed going out on a strike with a bunch of other miners outside the Never Sweat Mine. Once again, the Butte miners, Anaconda Company under J.D. Ryan, brought in their own private security force, cordoned off the mine site. When the miners showed up to picket, the security force fired into the miners. There were like seven or eight miners who were shot. All of them were shot in the back. One of them actually died of peritonitis. So pretty nasty stuff going on. And it would stay that way through the 20s into the early 30s until the Great Depression, of course, and then the rise of FDR and the New Deal. And you see the passage of the Wagner Act, which is kind of the holy grail for organized labor in the United States. And then there was this huge spark of organizing across the country, and Montana jumped into that hands and foot. The American Federation of Labor wasn't real keen on organizing unskilled workers, so a organization within the AFL split off and formed the Congress of Industrial Organizations and started a second federation. They didn't care what you did for a living. If you wanted to have a union, you could have a union, and you could affiliate with the CIO. And so they established a federation office in the state of Montana in 1938 in East Helena called the Montana State Industrial Union Council. They proceeded to organize everybody else that the American Federation of Labor wasn't organizing. Butte miners reorganized, the lumber and sawmill workers, which hadn't, the workers that worked in the woods and in the sawmills and so forth, who hadn't attempted to organize since 1917, organized under the Lumber and Sawmill Workers, which was part of the AFL, and you saw this huge upswing in organized labor within the state and across the country. World War II happens. Labor and the federal government come up with some kind of working arrangement to where both sides behave themselves for the most part. There is some labor activity going on during the war, but for the most part, things are pretty static. Prices are held low, wages are held low, while everybody works on the greater threat, and so forth going forward. But at the end of the war in 1946, you've got this huge boom. Corporations are making money hands over fist, and the workers decide they want their own bite. And so they start going out on strikes. And so you look at some of the numbers of the individuals that are going out on strike. We're talking 500,000 people with the United Mine Workers. We're talking, it's incredible. 750,000 with the steel workers going out on strike in 1946, 1947. The same thing's happening on a slightly smaller scale in Montana as well. And so that pretty much, I shouldn't say ends, but it puts a damper on the golden age of labor organizing in the United States. Because in 1947, the Labor Management Relations Act, or the Taft-Hartley, passes Congress. And Congress is able to override President Truman's veto. A couple of ways they do this. One, for the first time since the Great Depression, the Republicans have a majority in the House and the Senate. And so they have the numbers to do so. Two, in the 1940s, the labor movement, the American labor movement, is making a push south of the Mason-Dixon line into the southern states. And the southern Dixiecrats, the southern Democrats, don't like the idea of having organized labor in their states. And so the Republicans, with the assistance of the southern Dixiecrats, vote to pass the Labor Management Relations Act. And then they vote together as a block again to override Truman's veto. And so we are stuck with Taft-Hartley to this day. It does bring labor back together in a way that it hadn't been in quite a while, because the American Federation of Labor and the Congress of Industrial Organizations realized in 1955 that, wow, if we're going to survive this, we need to be united instead of divided. And so they merged in 1955, and the state federations did the same thing the following year in 1956. Again, during this time period, you see a different branch or a different type of organizing that hadn't been prevalent before. The Montana Nurses Association decides they're going to take a swing at becoming not just a professional development organization for the nurses, but also a union representing nurses. So they go for collective bargaining rights. Mary Munger manages to get it through the legislature on a two-year trial period. After the 2 years, they decided, hey, this does seem to be working okay, so nurses were given collective bargaining rights. And when I say nurses, the Montana Nurses Association at the time represented registered nurses, not LPNs or any of the other nurses, but just the RNs. So you see different type of organizing going on. 1967, these are the strikes that just happened in Montana, which is pretty impressive. How many strikes have there been in Montana in the last 10 years? Emory's doesn't count. There's a lockout. Yeah, this is 1 year. Also saw the longest strike of the Anaconda Company of 8 months. You also saw the end of the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers when they merged with the steel workers after the strike. So 1967 was kind of a watershed year for organized labor in this state. From that, sprung into the early 1970s, you have the writing of the 1972 Constitution for Montana and its passage. You see the Collective Bargaining Act for Public Employees passed in 1973. 2 years later, you see that extended to teachers and paraprofessionals and so forth in education in 1975. So things are progressing. Labor is reaching beyond its boundaries of traditional organizing and reaching other groups. That comes to a screeching ass halt in 1980 when the air traffic controllers went out on strike. The air traffic controllers had been working under pretty horrendous conditions for a while. The FAA wasn't the greatest employer in the world. They decided to go on strike in 1981. But in doing so, they violated their collective bargaining agreement, which said that they could not go out on strike because if they went out on strike, that put public safety at risk. So Ronald Reagan stepped in as President of the United States and enforced the collective bargaining agreement and told the striking air traffic controllers they had X number of days to go back to work. If they didn't, he would fire them. And so maybe A quarter of them went back to work. The majority stayed out. Reagan held true to his word and fired him. Not only did he fire them, he blackballed them from federal employment from thereafter. And as a matter of fact, they remained blackballed until President Clinton lifted that order and said, no, you got to hire some of these people back. So that was really kind of a wake-up call for American corporations, because nobody had really taken labor on in quite a while, not to this extent. So that was followed by the strike by the Hormel plant in the Midwest, Phelps Dodge down in Texas, where the corporations were able to beat the locals, beat the international unions at their own game, and shut them down. And so you see a drastic decline in strike activity across the United States after that point. Now, I promised a little bit of something on MSU, so here we go. So MSU organizing was it was organized in 1920 for just a short bit. I got some records from the American Federation of Teachers archivist at Wayne State University in Detroit. He sent me some nice correspondence. Unfortunately, the charter doesn't exist anymore. So if you work at MSU, dig around a little bit. Maybe you find the charter. That would be kind of cool, right? But there is correspondence about the professors there organizing and forming a local. But like a lot of those locals in the 1920s, they just didn't have the depth and breadth to stay together. And so they drifted apart. Same thing happened at the University of Montana. Same thing happened with K-12 education until Butte in 1935. 1989, again, all of a sudden they're talking about organizing the professors at Montana State University. And then in 2009, they actually do vote to establish a local for the tenured and non-tenured track professors at MSU. That lasts about 3 years before they hold a decertification vote in 2012. And by six votes, they vote to decertify the local there. So you have the Supreme Court decision in the Teens, the Janus decision, which basically establishes right to work across the United States for public employees. This basically means we cannot charge a representation fee of members of the bargaining unit who don't wish to actually pay dues. You used to be able to get a percentage that they would pay as a representation fee because they got all the same benefits that those who paid full dues got for the local. The Janus decision at the Supreme Court undid all of that. And so basically the United States is right to work across the board for public employees of all sorts. Right to work in the United States, right to work states, have fluctuated over the last few years. You saw some early successes in the mid-teens with Scott Walker and some of those individuals cramming through right-to-work legislation, and then a couple of those states overturned the right-to-work legislation a few years after those gentlemen left office. So we're about half and half. One of the biggest watershed moments for Montana in that regard was the Emery's lockout in 2018, when the French International Corporation decided it didn't want to bargain with 35 members of Local D-239 of the Boilermakers and decided just to lock them out and forget them. And that really brought Montana labor together in a way that it hadn't been in a long, long time. And you saw unions across the board figuring out a way to make monetary donations, food donations, clothing donations, donations for books and school materials and things like that for the kids. For 80 days, those 35 people held out against an international corporation and then brought them back to the table and won it. So it's pretty impressive. Here's some of the newspaper articles about that. Randy Tosi, I don't think you can say enough about that gentleman holding together that small of a local against that kind of pressure. Emory's went as far as hiring a out-of-state corporation to come in to run the plant. So basically professional strike-breaking scabs to break the lockout, and they couldn't do it. So Tosi held them together through all of that by sleeping in his truck 24/7 outside the property line of Emory, so he couldn't get arrested for trespassing. It's pretty goddamn impressive what they pulled off. So the election in 2020, there was the assumption that Montana would be the next right-to-work state with the sweep across the board. Maybe not. But
They sure as hell gave it a try, didn't they? So beginning in 2021, right out of the starting blocks, they started coming out with right-to-work legislation. This is the thing that makes Montana unique. If you look back in the papers and in the labor records and things like that, Republicans and Democrats courted labor in Montana. It wasn't one party. It was a collaboration across party lines with labor to defend labor. And I think that that's what you're seeing now, because you see right-to-work legislation in 21, you see right-to-work legislation in 23, you see right-to-work legislation in 25. What's going to happen in 27? Right-to-work legislation with a lame-duck governor. That's not a shot at Gianforte at all. We just don't know what he's going to do because nothing's landed on his desk yet. Wyoming shut down an opportunity that their legislature presented to the governor to do away with dues withdrawal from paychecks and so forth, and vetoed it and managed to hold that veto. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in 2027 and going forward. So, like the famous author said, labor in Montana is always in dubious battle. The struggle's never over. So you got to strap up to show up in 27. And that's the fast version. Whew. Yes, sir.
What happened to UPS 97 strike?
Oh, well, again, I limited amount of time. You give me 4 hours and I'll start notching.
UPS gets enough credit. It's okay.
Any questions, comments, queries?
Is there a way to access this material, or do you have it in another?
This is a PowerPoint presentation that I put together from four others, so this is Frankenstein's monster. What I do have that I've been working on for the last umpteen years is a fairly long timeline of labor history for Montana, going back to that territorial period to current. And as I get things like the UPS strike in 1997, I start plugging that kind of stuff in as well. I do have that. That's probably going to be of more worth than this is, if you're interested at it. So if you get me an email address, or if I can send it to Natsuki and she can disperse it from there, that's probably the best place to go, or best place to look. It also lists the number of labor newspapers that existed in Montana over time in various locations and things that were supportive of labor, which is kind of interesting to see as well. So, anything else? Yes, sir.
So the people that organized the strikes, were they ever blackballed, or they couldn't go back to work?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They were blackballed. Interesting fun fact. A bunch of years ago, we did a field trip. The library and archive staff, where I work at the Historical Society, to Butte, and did a tour of Butte and the Butte Civil War archives and all that kind of good stuff. And at that time, the water company and Butte's records were on site. And so when we were there, we were looking around and stuff. The guy who was the head librarian at the time asked if he could look at one of the cards, and they said, sure. And so he was looking at the cards, and he's going through the cards, and the cards are, you know, circa 20, circa 30, and things like that. And he's starting to notice that, hey, on the bottom of the water card for the water company, it says blackballed for labor agitation. So, I mean, so yeah, they did that quite a bit, getting blackballed, getting strung up. I mean, they did kill Frank. Somebody killed Frank a little. And so intimidation was something that was used quite regularly. 1917, when they broke the IWW, the federal government finally stepped in September. They put about 80 of them on trial in Chicago in 1918 and convicted the majority of them on treason and sedition. They received anywhere from 20 to 5-year sentences in the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth. So, yeah, they did everything that they could to break them. Mucky McDonald, about 3 or 4 years after getting out of Montana State Prison in 1916, applied for citizenship, and the courts denied him citizenship because of his strike activity in 1914. So, yeah. Yes, sir.
Did
Is there further connection between Butte and Bisbee organizing other than the Frank Little, with them both being copper mining?
The IWW connection, obviously, and the Western Federation of Miners. And I just thought of the guy's name, Roy S. Alley. There we go. Who has an interesting connection to my hometown, Libby, with the development of the Zonalite mine with all the asbestos in it. His brother developed that mine. So we can blame that on the Anaconda Company, too.
Nice.
There is that union connection. The interesting thing about the IWW is the Western Federation of Miners was one of the founders of the organization. So initially, the WFM was supposed to be the organizing arm of the hard rock miners for the IWW. At one point between 1905 and 1914, the IWW and the Western Federation of Miners had a hard split. And then they were at war with one another. And that's probably been one of the bigger detriments to organized labor in the United States, is the fighting between the unions as opposed to the unions making the good fight for the workers. Again, that's one of the rare things about Montana, is you don't see a hell of a lot of that. The Montana Federation of Labor, the AFL side, and the Montana State Industrial Union Council, the CIO side, didn't fight with one another over jurisdiction, over who was going to organize who. They figured out a way to work around and together to get things accomplished. And again, that's one of the unique things about this state. We're surrounded by right-to-work states. Dakotas went in 47, Wyoming went in 63, Idaho went in the 90s. It's pretty amazing that we are not. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
Do you think the future of unions is either Montana or nationwide?
What's that?
What do you think about the future of unions of labor nationwide or Montana?
Well, the nice thing about my job is most of the stuff I talk about, they're all dead. So I know the outcome. So that's kind of the nice part about that. If I was going to put money down on it, it's going to get worse. But the thing about worse is people's backbones stiffen and they step into it. And so we see how hard Montana labor steps into it. And so far, they've done pretty good. So even with saying it's going to get worse, I wouldn't bet against them. My family moved from Wyoming in 1966. I asked my dad why they moved from Wyoming to Montana. He leaned in real close and got real gravelly like dads do. And he said, because Wyoming's fucking right to work. So this is why we ended up here, and that's why he was a union man. So, yeah, that's why.
Did the union get stronger when there was more unemployment or less unemployment?
There's a tendency for unions to get stronger during times of turmoil. When things are going easy and smooth and everything, unions have a tendency to get complacent. If you look back at the history of the whole right-to-work situation for the public sector and things like that, unions got lazy. I'll take a black eye for that if somebody wants to take a swing. But instead of being aggressive, instead of pushing, they basically pulled in and tried to protect what they had. And that's not a good move. Defense is necessary. But if you're going to survive, you need the offense to back it up. So, and we've seen unions take the offense, and we've seen some wins, what we call wins. Everybody talked about the upsurge of the strike activity in the country a few years ago with the kind of organic strike activity that was going on back in Tennessee and places like that, especially with educators and things like that. And it's like, ooh, it's a brand new age. But if you put that on a graph, it's a blip. We'll see what happens when it hits the high water mark. So if we see another huge economic downturn like the Depression was, I imagine unions are going to get significantly more membership out of that. Like I said, there has a tendency to drift off when things are smooth. There's no need for it, right? Anything else? Yes, sir. You only get two questions, I'm telling you right now. That's it.
This one's a little bit further off to the side, but do you have anything to talk about on connections between labor organizing and tenant organizing, Montana?
And what organizing?
Tenants organizing.
Tenants?
Yeah.
Oof. I haven't bumped into anything like that, but it'd be interesting to see if there's something along those lines. It'd have to be something like someplace in Butte. Maybe poke around online in the newspapers. So if you go to... There's a tenant union here now?
That's why I'm
asking. Okay, that's why you're asking? Okay. Yeah, no, that's going to be something, you know, that's something new that's going to be interesting to see how that develops going forward. Because, again, that's basically just people who cannot, even working, make enough to afford to pay rent. And we see that with people that we employ all the time.
Right, there's a rent strike currently against two of the local trailer parks. Because the pad rent was raised exorbitantly. So starting May 1st, they are on strike, a rent strike.
How long has it been going on?
Since May 1st.
Okay.
So they're withholding their rent payments because the owner will not sit down. They tried for a couple of years to sit down with him and talk about issues, maintenance issues, and infrastructure.
What will be?
Bring them to the table. So it's kind of like a last
ditch effort. It'll be interesting to see if the owner just holds out until it reaches the point where he can start issuing eviction notices and the law enforcement has to get into it.
That's what
he says. New owner, he sold out. Today was?
Yeah, that'll be kind of interesting. Interesting enough, that was one of the things that helped the Butte miners get reorganized in 1935 when they went out on strike. For the first time, Butte law enforcement stayed the hell out of it. They refused to get drawn into the fight on the side of the company. They said they were neutral, and they stayed neutral. And the governor held his water and didn't issue a call for National Guardsmen to show up and break the strike either. So it'll be interesting to see how that unspools going forward. Anything else? I get paid by the hour, people.
What are your thoughts on overturning Janus?
I don't think that's going to happen. Not unless most of the U.S. Supreme Court gets wiped out in one quick move.
How do we do that?
You and I will talk later. In a more private setting, I have some thoughts, but we will share those just amongst ourselves. The U.S. Supreme Court is not a branch of the government to ignore, for sure. And some of the things that they're doing, it's going to take decades, if not centuries, to overturn. So it's, honestly, the quickest way to do it is to stop having them appointed by the president and Congress and have them elected. Just like the Supreme Court justices are elected in Montana. So you have to stand for election and declare a goddamn party. Because it's nonpartisan stuff. There's no such thing. All right.